The White Network presents Saturday Afternoon with Carolyn. Your host, Carolyn Yeager.
And good day, ladies and gentlemen. Thanks for joining me on this 22nd day of February. My guest is the always interesting Dr. Professor Andreas R. Vesserle. With more information on the Allied bombing of Germany and other bad things that happened to Germany in the 1940s. But before he calls in, I have time to tell you that I changed the break music for this program. I wanted to find some old-timey American music for a change of pace and songs about love between white men and women and things along that nature, getting away from the German music and the German language for this show for a while. And so I came across, what do you know, Andy Griffith and Joanna Moore singing together on a YouTube video. I liked it very much. I liked the male and female voices singing together. So I decided on that, and the song they were singing happened to be Down in the Valley. I picked that out. Now, I'll finish when I get back, just as soon as I answer the call, because Andreas is calling in. So let me get over to my, I hope he hangs on there. I have to get over to my Skype page. Okay. No, I did something wrong. All right. 30. Oops, he hung up. See, I was too late. I guess he will do it again. He'll call again. So maybe he thought he was too early. So I'll continue with what I was saying and wait for him to call. So I was looking for another song with Valley in it, and the best I could come up with was Woody Guthrie singing Red River Valley. There are a lot of Red River Valleys, but you know, then I have to have a certain number, a certain time, so these two add up to just about 5 minutes. So that's what the break music will be now, starting today. The Andy Griffith and Joanna Moore first, and then Woody Guthrie singing about valleys and love. Now, another tidbit that I learned, I looked up Andy Griffith just to find out if he didn't have anything bad in his past that I might not want to, have him singing on my program. No, he didn't have anything. He was a lifelong Democrat, I guess, but that's okay. So are a lot of people, my family included. So, but otherwise he's got a pretty good past. And I found out that he had put together a primetime 1-hour television show, which premiered in 1980, called The Yeagers, and spelled just like my name, Y-E-A-G-E-R. But after the first show, it never went over. I don't even know if they did the second one. They might have. But it never made it. It was one of those, it was kind of a bonanza type show with a father, Griffith being the father, and had a bunch of sons, and he was a successful timber mining, self-made businessman. It looked pretty good, but I guess something was wrong with it. It didn't go over. And I think now after a while, I have a vague memory that somebody might have told me that there was a TV program like that. But I did not ever, I wasn't paying attention to TV or a lot of things in that year. I had certain years in my life that were pretty active and lots of changes and so on. So I was distracted by other things. So I hope that I'm done now with my little commentary here. So I hope Andreas calls back in shortly if he's listening. I don't know if he listens, but I hope he calls back in. You know, he's not on Skype, so I can't send him a Skype message. I just can only think that maybe he thought he should wait a few minutes. All right. We're going to be talking about Allied bombing in Germany, and I'm also going to bring up somewhere along the line that we've just had the anniversary of the arrest of Hans and Sophie Scholl, who were the main participants that are known today. Not that she wasn't the main participant, but she's more famous than her brother today. Okay, here he is now, and I can get right on it. Me and my trouble with numbers. Okay, there he is.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon to you, Dr. Vesserlay. I am so sorry I took so long to answer your first call that you hung up probably thinking you were calling too early, huh?
Right. That's
yes.
Right.
Well, I got my preliminary thing about my new break music in and so on. So I'm just ready for you, and I'm real happy that you did call back without waiting too long. So, you know, sometimes I just make a mistake. I get my numbers wrong. I just start all over. I have to get my Skype page up. I'm very slow, turns out, about a lot of things. So that's
well,
why
that
I suppose...
happens in the best of families, you know.
Yeah, it happens in the best of when you've lived long enough, it starts happening. So that's what I think it is with me, although probably it was always a little bit that I was always a little bit that way.
Yeah. How did you like those photographs of the air raids on Munich?
Well, I liked them very much, and I want to say that to tell the listeners too that I have got them up where they can view them, all four of them, on my website. So if you go, I did that last night and this morning. So I changed the picture that I originally had for this program, which is just the announcement of the program. But I changed it to one of those pictures, and I'll just tell them now that if they go to carolynyager.net, and the very first blog post there is the one for today's program, and you'll see that one of the pictures is there bombing the Opera House of Munich, the big heavy U.S. bombs from the B-29s, I guess, that are
B-24s, probably.
Okay.
B-24s.
Thank you. B-24s. And in daylight. And then and you can click on that picture and enlarge it. Although I don't have very big enlargements, and I might be able to get the... I had to separate the pictures that came in a group of three. So then I didn't have enough time to figure out if I could get them bigger. But you can still see everything very clearly. And then... in the image caption, I added here, here, and here, where you can see more pictures. If you click on those, you'll see three more of the photos from bombing in Munich. And so, why don't we start out with that, Andreas? And you can tell us about those pictures and what you know about the bombing. And we, you know, you've got quite a few things here. We've got quite a few little sideline topics to cover concerning that. So I also have here, and maybe I should mention this because you might find it interesting, that I decided to look and see what else was going on February 22nd and in history. Because sometimes, you know, it's a big anniversary and you don't know about it. I don't want to miss it.
Right.
And just a couple things that are interesting. In 1991, on this date, the George Bush, the Daddy Bush, declared full-scale war with Iraq if Iraq didn't pull out of Kuwait immediately.
Yeah.
And that was the beginning of that first Iraqi war. And then in 1938, Hitler spoke in the Reichstag and declared, at least this is according to this official history line, you know, declared that the Austrian protection, Germany's Austrian protection, which he said that oppressed and persecuted Germans in Austria, Czechoslovakia, and the rest of the world were under the protection of Germany, and force will be used if necessary for their protection. This thing says Germany does not want war, but will protect its people with war if needed. Now, I don't know if he mentioned war or not, but they say he did. And then they say that together with the alliance of Italy and Japan, this was 38, with Germany and Germany's large buildup of military power, France and Great Britain believe a second world war may well be inevitable. So, you know, they already thought it was inevitable, didn't they, in 1938?
Right.
Yeah. So, and then, in response to that, well, go ahead. You want to comment on that?
Well, since I didn't hear the radio transcription, you know, and I don't have the black or white document in front of me, but I doubt that he mentioned the Second World War. Because he was just too canny a diplomat to do that, you know.
Yeah, well, it doesn't say Second World War. It says, they just put the, they don't, it's not a quote, but they just say as though he said it, Germany does not want war, but will protect its people with war if needed. This must have been like from the newspapers or something.
Yeah.
I don't know if he mentioned much one, two. He might have said we'll protect our people with all necessary means or something, right?
Yeah.
But I didn't have time to look that up either. I don't even know where I'd if I could find it that easily.
And then, you know, Austria as such was regarded as a German region.
By 1938, February 22nd. No, it was in March that
March then.
Yeah. Yeah, so this is right before the Anschluss, but it was coming up and everybody knew it.
Right.
Uh-huh.
And a number of elections had taken place before that, in the 1920s.
Mm-hmm.
And in those elections, the people in various states in Austria, as it was called, like Salzburg and Tyrol and so on, had declared themselves overwhelmingly in favor of union, not necessarily Anschluss, you know, but union with Germany. Something like 91-93% of everybody wanted to be in the same state, you know, as the fellow Germans on the other side of the border. That was the actual situation at the time.
Right, exactly. And then on that same day that Hitler was speaking, there was supposed to be a speech by the Secretary of the Interior in the United States. This was Ickes, I-C-K-E-S. They don't give his first name. And they don't actually say he actually gave the speech, but he released the notes from his speech. Or maybe this was written before the speech, but they released the notes and he was, In his speech, he urged all democracies to fight against, using the words repulse against, internal fascism and communism.
Uh-huh.
And his speech was scheduled to be heard in Canada, Australia, New Zealand, the United Kingdom, India, and South Africa, as well as U.S. But he commented that he was speaking as an individual and not as a representative of the president or the United States.
Well, that's baloney, you know. I mean, if an important person in the cabinet comes out with an opinion like that, that can be regarded as official, you know.
You know what this sounds like now, I realize. It sounds like he was prepared to give this anti-communist, anti-fascist speech. And then they heard him. That would have been, they're in a different time zone, but then Hitler talked. And that may have thrown some, thrown something into the some problem into him giving this speech. So maybe he never did give the speech. But the notes had been released. Oh, well. Anyway, that's on one of those pages, you know. What happened on this day last year? I mean, in the past, you know.
A few years ago, yeah.
Yeah. Well, please, would you please go on and let me just remind the listeners who probably are familiar with you, but that you are, and listeners who will be listening later on, that, you know, you are well educated and well versed and well read and well even as a writer in these areas that we're going to be talking about today. And so you're able to say a lot of things just from your general font, store of knowledge. So I'll just let you go ahead, I hope, and discuss these things with us.
Well, thank you. We were discussing the Western strategic bombing offensive against Germany, and it's never admitted by, especially not by the Brits, but it seems almost totally sure that Winston Churchill and his good friend, the so-called scientific advisor, Dr. Lindemann, also known as Lord Shalwell, targeted German cities, at least at first, that were, they belonged to the most beautiful cities in Europe, you know, like on purpose, like Lübeck on the Baltic Sea, which was once the headquarters of the Asiatic League, and Wismar and Rostock, and Cologne on the Rhine, and Hildesheim near Hanover, and Hanover itself, and Brunswick, and Münster, and Westphalia, where the Peace of Westphalia was signed in 1648, and Rothenburg of the Tauber, which a lot of Americans know about, because it's only about 30 miles east of Frankfurt. That's why a lot of American tourists go there.
Would you repeat that name? I didn't catch that.
Rothenburg of the Tauber, R-O-T-H-E-N-B-U-R-G, Rothenburg.
Rothenburg, uh-huh. Okay.
Yeah, it's the famous medieval city.
A lot of these cities were some of the oldest cities in Germany, oldest inhabited, and people aren't all that familiar with their names because they're, people today are more familiar with names that are big business cities of Germany, you know, or capital cities or what have you. But if you know Germany and you know German history, these are just like you said, you know, the most beautiful and historic places with old, irreplaceable buildings. And they went to these places and started bombing right off the bat.
That's right. And, of course, also Nuremberg in northern Bavaria, and then Munich itself, and Würzburg, which was a small city, also in northern Bavaria. And, of course, Salzburg, you know, the famous festival city, and Vienna, Wiener Neustadt, and many others. In all, there were 131 German towns and cities that were plastered with heavy air raids, 131 according to official sources, with heavy air raids. Mm-hmm. So that was quite a bit. And apparently also in January of 1955, a Swiss newspaper called Die Tat, T-A-T, Die Tat, claimed that Germany sustained 2,050,000 dead, not just casualties, but 2,050,000 dead from the air raids, which apparently includes both tactical and strategic attacks. So that's really horrendous.
Well, yeah, but now, you know, that's a number that we never hear that number.
Right.
And,
never.
You know, with the kind of bombing that they did, and I was reading, I have the book, The Fire, by Georg Friedrich, I think it is, or Friedrich Georg. I read large parts of it for quite a few months, the first half hour of every Heretics Hour program, to the listeners. And, you know, the kind of bombing was similar to the Dresden bombing in all kinds of other places. I mean, the same thing, the same experience that people had, all these people found dead and asphyxiated and so on in their shelters, you know, after it was all over and so on. And no way to really. And yet they say the number that they give, even in the 300,000 or something like that, maybe I didn't even check it out. Forgot to do that. It just doesn't seem large, considering that we had 2.5 years of this terrible kind of bombing residential areas.
Right. Actually, the bombing of residential areas started, and on a serious scale, in the spring of 1940, and it went on from 1940 until the last days of 1945. So what is that? 1, 2, 3, 4, almost 5 years of bombing, you know.
Go ahead.
What was I going to say?
Well, does this Swiss newspaper, Die Tat, and this was in 1955, so it wasn't, you know, it was closer to when it happened. That's better than somebody coming along and trying to revise it whole lot later. And this was this person named Eric Kern did this. Has anybody supported that, or has it been publicly attacked? And, you know, what's the results of this man coming out with this number?
I wish I had read that article, you know, and see exactly what kind of sources they relied on. But you can be sure that they were pretty close to the truth. If there was something like 250,000 or 300,000 dead in the case of Dresden alone, which of course was horrendous, and then Hamburg, you know, the big port city near the North Sea, sustained 55,000 dead.
It's probably more than that.
Through various air raids from 1939 until 1945, 55,000 dead. So if you add all the others, like Leipzig in Saxony, you know, and Pforzheim, which is a small town in Württemberg, Baden, in southwestern Germany, and Stuttgart, the big industrial city, and so on, you can easily come up with at least 1 million civilian dead, non-combatant dead, at least.
Well, it's just like what we're talking about with Dresden, the way they to bring that number down to 25,000 is just, you know,
ridiculous.
It's terrible. And then they go the opposite direction with things like, of course, the Holocaust, you know, where they try to dream up all these numbers.
Yeah, exactly. They increase that all the time. Yeah.
Yeah. Then it said that an awful lot of people can really survive these kind of air raids, but these were not so much the normal type of air raid because I don't know when they started, but by 1944 they were using these phosphorus bombs and these huge, you know, gigantic bombs and so on.
Right.
And they had a whole program. I know they started out with these dropping these red and yellow tracers or something like that and light things up, and then they'd drop something else, and then they'd bring another group would come in and drop the other stuff, and then they'd drop more other different kind of stuff so that, you know, people couldn't really didn't have the usual ability to sit it out somewhere, you know, and survive it.
There were several waves that came in, and when the fire brigades ran out to fight the fires, they blasted those with high explosives, so there would be very high casualties among the fire brigades, you know. They did that on purpose.
Yes.
And then
yes.
In Hamburg also, it is claimed that the British dropped delayed fuse bombs, bombs that would go off, not at that time, which was in July and August of 1943, but several weeks later, kind of a goodbye kiss, you know, from Winston Churchill. And then Winston Churchill himself, as that French politician and statesman said, he had a whole room full of photographs showing destroyed German cities, and he would jump around from one photograph to the other, and there were tables filled with photographs of destroyed cities, and jump up and down, and yoo-hoo, and go, you know, as if you were watching a soccer match. And he apparently never thought about the fact that he was killing, or to him it didn't count for anything, that he was killing hundreds of thousands of defenseless civilians, mostly women and children and old people.
They wanted to bring Germany to its knees right from the very beginning. I mean, that was the intention. And so they really didn't, they didn't want to look bad to the rest of the world, but they didn't want to allow any, you know, allow Germany to get, to be able to negotiate in any way for anything. And
right.
So I think that's why they were so ruthless. You know, the talking about the pictures, I was reading in that book that they would show the video. They would take video. You know, the planes had cameras on them and so on. And
yeah.
They would show these the pilots afterwards. They would, you know, bring them in like a movie screening room or something and show them the damage that was done and so on, and to make them feel like they had succeeded. And some of them didn't really like it. They didn't like seeing what they had done. Well, we even have some photographs of from the planes, not too many, but that show that just the total firepower that's going on down there, and the total, how the whole huge area is just covered with this bomb stuff going on,
right.
And red and yellow and so on. And well, now in those pictures that you sent me, there's huge puffs of smoke. You know, when I'm doing this series on the Wenger family and publishing the letters by Leopold Wenger, who was whose letters home, who was a fighter bomber, ended up fighter bomber pilot, flying over the Channel to attack in 42 and part of 43. English cities, mostly on the southern area, way down in the southern area there, where it was closest to them, you know, so they could get over there and back and everything.
Yeah.
And,
you know,
and he had pictures, you know, they're not the greatest pictures, but he'll show that we really gave it to him, and you'll see the picture. Of course, he's only got what his camera took, but you see one little puff of smoke coming up from somewhere. You know, that's it. I mean, so you can destroy something and it doesn't make, you know, you can pretty much, or you can put it out of commission and you see, you know, from the air, you see this little puff of smoke. But so when you see these huge conflagrations going on in these pictures of German cities, you know, it's an entirely different thing going on.
Sure.
Yeah. So these pictures that you sent me, like the one that I have there now on the program announcement of the Munich Opera House.
Right.
Talk to us about that a little bit. I mean, that's very big explosion and another big one next door to it. And yet even that doesn't take the whole opera house down.
Right.
What happened to the Opera House? That was, they got the back of it then. Did they destroy it, the whole thing? And what else did they destroy in Munich?
Yeah, it was totally destroyed. It was a neoclassical architecture. And now, of course, they rebuilt again with those columns in front, the Greek-style columns, very mm-hmm. big ones. And there were, I believe, 6 columns in front holding up the gable, the so-called pediment. And of those 6 columns, only 1.5 survived. All the others were smashed, and only 1.5 remained as stumps, So the entire opera house was really, for all intents and purposes, totally destroyed. And right next door to it, there was what was called the main post office of Munich, which was a product of the Romantic age of the 19th century. And the facade of that was patterned on the famous building in Florence, in Italy, by the famous architect Brunelleschi. And Brunelleschi, which apparently was the first Renaissance building in the 15th century in Florence, with various
that rotunda?
Round arches and pillars, like that, and the Renaissance style. And that's what they were trying to, that's what the architects in the 19th century Munich tried to recall again, and they copied that particular famous building from Florence by Brunelleschi, but they made it into a post office. In other words, there was post office garbed in the facade of the 15th century Florentine Renaissance building. And even that was bombed to smithereens, and all the buildings around it were totally destroyed. And
there's a lot of smoke coming up from behind there, too. Big black, even higher than what's coming off of the opera house, which maybe had just been hit. And there was this photographer, and you said some of these photographers were standing up on the top of buildings in the distance. Boy,
he climbed one of the 2 steeples of the cathedral, Our Lady's Cathedral, Frauenkirche, mm-hmm. which already been, to a large extent, had been gutted, but the steeples stood because of their rugged construction. They were built out of brick, not out of stone. The millions and millions of bricks had been built in the Middle Ages, and they were able to withstand even the severe explosions of near misses by blockbusters. But they were gutted. They were burned. The middle of it burned out. But before this happened, this particular man, the photographer, climbed one of those steeples to the top, and he took all these pictures of the entire neighborhood around the cathedral being smothered by huge bombs. 1,000 or 2,000 pound bombs. And
this man is a real hero. Does he have a name?
Yes, he was. The interesting thing is, I can't tell you for sure, but the socialist government in Munich, Munich has had a socialist government for many, many decades, even before 1933, the present-day socialists, anyway, I remember that some of the buildings in the at the University of Munich and the Ludwigstrasse, at the main street, which is close to the university, have some of the holes made by strafing Allied fighters or fighter bombers. And they had 2-centimeter or 3-centimeter guns, and they would fire at anything that moved. And so some of these holes were still there in some of these brick buildings near the or at the university. But what the socialists are doing is they're blaming the Germans for that. And if the Germans had fired into their own buildings, you know, that's ridiculous.
No, they would. That's just what they would do. Well, I have this little note here, and I don't know if this is from it says the theater designed by Leo von Klenze. I don't know if this is the opera house or the theater, a big theater building in Munich. But
yeah, there are quite a few theaters, you know. But
yes, right. It was bombed, it was gutted in an air raid on the night of 3 October 1943. Is that the date of when this was a nighttime, it says. Was this the date when the opera house was bombed? Or was that later?
Well, it was bombed several times, matter of fact. You know?
Yeah.
Right. So the pictures that we have are during daytime raids, so there was mm-hmm. not a night.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, so, well, this one, it says it was neo-Greco designed by Leo von Klenze with portico, triangular pediments, and so on, Corinthian columns. In 1925, it was modified to create an enlarged stage area with updated equipment, and then it was gutted in an air raid on the night of October 3rd, 1943. This was in Munich.
Well, it was hit several times, matter of fact. Now I'm trying to think of a town in Tyrol.
Well, let me say one more thing about Munich. You know, in these pictures that are on my website now, if you go to that first post there, one of them is in the front of, showing is in 1945, after it was all over, showing horses grazing in the front of the Alta Pinot. Pinotech, so that's Munich's greatest, most famous art gallery or art museum. And that looks like it was totally destroyed.
Right, it was hit by 2 heavy bombs.
Yeah. Okay. And then and you mentioned as we know, the paintings were not in there. Important paintings were all stored in the salt mines, and that's where they try to make a lot of propaganda that the salt mines contained artwork stolen by Hitler and his Nazis, and you know they were hiding it there from the Allies and so on. God,
they're putting that on again at the moment, and they're always repeating the same old claims, which are really unsubstantiated. You know.
Mm-hmm. Right, and so, but the building, you know, itself was destroyed. So they were bombing all that whole area of where all the culture was, you know, the central Munich. And another picture shows the big bomb hitting the Karlsplatz Plaza, which is locally known as Stachus.
Stachus.
You want to talk about that?
Right.
Yeah, can you talk about that a little bit?
Well, that's one of the main boulevards, you might call it, where there used to be the medieval wall. And so in the 19th century, especially during Napoleon's time, he didn't want any walls to stand, which might offer resistance to Napoleon. So all these walls were torn down, and they built parks, round or semicircular parks, and where those walls had been. So the Stachus, or Karlsplatz, is now one of the main boulevards in Munich, you know. And, that was also bombed very heavily. And on the photograph it shows on the left, there's the so-called Palace of Justice, or the Justice Building, where there is courts and stuff like that in it. And there was also bombed in smithereens. Mm-hmm. And on the right side, somewhat in the distance, there's kind of a horizontal building also in the neoclassical style, which was, it still is, the St. Boniface Monastery and Church, and that was also bound to smithereens. Matter of fact, I lived in that place for a number of months. And, of course, it's been rebuilt and all that, but the church now is only about maybe one-half or one-third what it used to be before 1943, you know, before the heavy air raids began. Mm-hmm. So they were carpet bombing pretty much everything. Yeah, but
carpet bombing, and I know you wanted to say something about Tyrol, but the fourth picture, which can be seen very large, and I'm still have to see if I can enlarge to get the rest of those in a larger size, because you sent them somewhere I saw was pretty large, but I had to separate them, and so that's what I ended up with. But the other one that's not been separated was the carpet bombing, and this is in Munich too, and it shows St. Peter's Church is in the foreground, and it's right. Not being bombed during that picture, but it's already been gutted. But in the distance, you see, I thought, are those trees or is that smoke? You know, what is that? It's smoke. It's a whole line of what you call carpet bombing. They're just going across there. How do they do that? Does one plane have all those bombs, or they have a series of planes?
There were hundreds of heavy planes and hundreds of four-engine planes. And
Well, they have one after the other or something, so they just keep...
One after the other, right. But they were in squadron, you know, left and right. Mm-hmm. And they're also doing that for defense. If any German fighter should come along, they'll have a more concentrated field of fire for defense, you know.
Okay.
But anyway, they drop it usually from a height of 30,000 feet or 27,000 feet, something like that, 9,000 meters. And they dropped several hundred heavy bombs pretty much almost at the same time, you know.
And this was outside of the central part there, and it was in the residential area.
Right.
This was clearly where they were destroying the housing of the working people.
Right, right. This particular quarter is called Bogenhausen. It's purely residential. And it was middle class mostly. And also some museums and fraternity houses, parks, and stuff like that. So there was nothing remotely militarily important, you know. They were just, I guess what they were trying to do is crush the morale of the German people so the Germans will rise up sometime, maybe 1943 or 44, and surrender to the Allies, you know. That's what they want to do.
Yeah, so I'm not going to forget about Tyrol, but let's not, maybe this is a good time to discuss a little more how Churchill and Lindemann had this plan or had this idea of really what is genocide. To genocide, you use the word genocide, German people. Can you go into that a little bit more? And what was Lindemann's first name, Dr. Who Lindemann?
Goodness, Frederick. One of his first names was Frederick.
Okay, yeah.
And, of course, then he got the title of Lord Charwell, which you pronounce Charwell or Cherwell in American, because the Char was a brook that flows through Oxford. And Lindemann was an instructor at Oxford University.
Oh, that's how that works. So,
yeah, did that in his honor of a mass murder. He said that in 1942, by 1943, we should have 10,000 heavy bombers with four engines, especially the Lancaster, which was especially a good design. And with that, we should be able to eradicate 58 German cities and de-house 22 million people. In other words, 22 million people will be forced to leave those cities. Of course, if you if you destroy 58 big cities, actually they pretty much destroyed 131 towns and cities. But if you do that, you would have millions of casualties, you know. But they just didn't mention that. It was totally ignored. It was just one little thing. And Sir Arthur Harris, or he became Sir later on, Bomber Harris, Arthur Harris, he was the general who was put in command of the bombing command. And he was totally in favor of untargeted, just plain general bombing of an entire city, aerial bombing, which in the claim was this would knock out all the water and the power and the gas and all that, all those networks, and would also damage the big industrial sites, which is actually not true, because the industrial sites were repaired relatively easily. But it was a residential district, especially the labor class district, which are very closely bunched together, or the apartment houses about five or six floors high.
Right.
And those would be bombed preferentially, because there are especially many people in there, and they wanted to kill as many people as possible, allegedly to undermine the German wartime morale. You know, but actually, it was just a nihilistic attack on the German population. And they also, by the way, used similar tactics in France. France was the second worst hit country in Europe, and Italy will be in third place. Excuse me. And so they caused a lot of casualties and millions of dead non-combatants.
Right, and they and a lot of this was going, what was going on in the daytime? Was that all United States?
Mostly the United States. And the night raids were specialized in by the British.
Mm-hmm.
And they developed various techniques and various tactics. Because in the beginning, like in 1939 or early 1940, they would come in with a mass of bombers, even at night. They would be shot down very easily by the German fighter planes, because, of course, fighter planes are much faster than the bombers. And the British bombers were unescorted because the Spitfire and the Hurricane didn't have the requisite range to accompany the bombers into Germany.
Oh, I see. That's why in the beginning, well, they were having terrible losses, these bomber planes, these end of
pilots. Oh, they were shot down, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, and that was a scandal. But I read, I think, that the British authorities didn't really let the population know how bad it was, but that the pilots knew. And every time they went on to get in their planes to go on one of these raids, they knew they were going very likely to their death.
That's right.
That's why they want to build this. They wanted to build this this memorial to them, because they were just sacrificial lambs for a long time, and maybe in large part there was nobody to fight them off. But you know, and so they thought they were so brave and they deserved it. But it was in their own plan, their own doing, that that caused that.
That's correct at the beginning, but then these early bombers, the ones in 1939, were all two-engine bombers, especially the Wellington, which was kind of a sturdy plane, and then some others, Bristol, Blenheim, and so on. And as I said, in the beginning, they used to bunch their bombers together, but then later on, after 1941, 42, especially after that big 1,000 bomber raid on Cologne in 1942, they evolved a new strategy, or I should say tactics, by which the British bombers would arrive over the target, like drop by drop, and not in one big bunch, which would be easy to find by night fighters, but individually, all together, but still individually on the tactical level. So they were much less easy to bring down by the night fighters. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, then when they started attacking Hamburg in July and August 1943, they used this window aluminum paper, whatever it was, metallic paper, which they throw down.
Aluminum strips, they called them. Aluminum strips.
Yeah, they were strips which would cut to such a length as to disable the German radar. Mm-hmm. That's why the attack on Hamburg was so, you know, from their point, successful.
So devastating.
But so extensive, yeah. Because the airplanes couldn't, and the fighters couldn't get into the air because they didn't know exactly where the enemy was, you know.
Yeah, they were, all throughout those few years, they were busy making improvements to disable radar, to do this or that, or to improve their radar and find new ways. And when one would come up with something, then the other side would figure that out, and then they'd do something to overcome that.
Let me say one more thing here. Up to now, we've been concentrating on the strategic four-engine bomber air raids. But, of course, also a lot of damage, maybe even more important damage, was done by the tactical planes, by the two-engine bombers later on after 1941, and by the fighter bombers, the Typhoons and Mustangs and so on. And the Lightning was a twin-engine American fighter called Lightning, P-something or other. Was a P-38 or some? Anyway, the Lightning was a long-range fighter. It was not very maneuverable because it had two engines, but it was long-range. It was pretty fast, so it was sought out for long-range attacks. But anyway, so there was this village in Tyrol, in southern Tyrol, called, I believe, Marein. And it's hidden in a gorge, in an alpine gorge, so like a small Grand Canyon, like a small canyon, you know. Mm. And so the German economy or the various managers decided to build a strategically important factory in that gorge. Now, I don't know whether they made whatchamacallums. What do you call those? At the moment, I forgot. Anyway, it was strategically important. Not tanks, not planes, just a small component that's necessary for the effective functioning of an engine. So they put the factory into that small canyon in the Alps. Mm-hmm. And sure enough, various American bombers came along, including two-engine bombers and four-engine bombers. They tried various methods of attack, but they could never knock that factory out because it was so well hidden.
Well, it was probably well defended, too, was it?
Most likely, yes.
Any aircraft guns?
Yeah, but they destroyed the entire village, which, of course, was not the target. Uh-huh. But they were so mad. that they, instead of hitting the factory, they destroyed the village, which originally had been very colorful. And then, to top it off, these women, the Tyrolean women, it shows there's a city hall, there's a big painting of it, a fresco on the facade. They had a funeral to bury these people that had been killed in the air raids. And then all of a sudden, these American Lightning two-engined planes came swooping down and shot all the people in the funeral.
Oh.
They attacked the funeral. Most of them were, of course, women and so on, who had left, lost their relatives.
My goodness.
Yeah, they could see that these were going towards or from the church, you know, and you can see all that from the air. But nonetheless, they...
Well, you'd think these people would have been really angry, but instead they went along with the winners, you know, and stayed on that side or went on that side or so on after the war. Just about everybody.
Yeah.
You know, it just it doesn't give you a lot of confidence for getting the truth out. Well, we're ready to go on our break. We've got just a few seconds. So, Dr. Esserle, just hold on. Hang on to your telephone there or put it down for we've got about 5 minutes and we'll be back.
All right. Thank you.
Down in the valley, so low, hang your head over, hear the wind blow, hear the wind blow, dear, hear the wind blow, hang your head over. Don't love me, love whom you please. Throw your arms round me, give my heart ease.
Give my heart ease, dear, give my heart ease. Throw your arms round me.
Love sunshine, violets love dew, angels in heaven know I love you, know I love you, dear, know I love you, angels in heaven.
Hasten to bid me adieu. Just remember that Red River Valley and the cowboy that loved you so true. Well, they tell me, my dear, that you're going. I will miss your bright eyes and your smile. For with you, you are taking the sunshine that has brightened my life for a while. So come sit by my side if you love me. Do not hasten to bid me adieu. Just remember that Red River Valley and the cowboy that loves you so true.
Thank you.
those sweet hours that we spend in that Red River Valley. And the love we exchange with the flowers. So come sit by my side if you love me. Do not hasten to bid me adieu. Just remember that Red River Valley and the cowboy that loved you so true. I have waited a long time, my darling, for those words that you never would say. Till at last as my poor heart is breaking, oh, they tell me you're going away. So come sit by my side if you love me. Do not hasten to bid me adieu. Just remember that Red River Valley and that cowboy that loved you so true.
Well, welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. I hope you enjoyed that. As I said in the beginning of the program, that's the new break music for this program for a while, and it's my contribution to true love and romance between our men and our women that we would certainly like if we lived in easier times that we could spend, we could enjoy that kind of a leisurely existence better than we are able to do now, but we don't want to lose everything. So my guest today is my good friend, Dr. Andreas Wesserly. Are you there again, Dr. Wesserly?
Here I am.
Here you are. All right. Well, we're getting back to these this subject of the Allied bombing, and I think we could go now to talking about the planes. I know there was some... You had some commentary about that, and also there was some comments written after your show. What show was it? Yeah, I guess it was after the show with you, the last time you were on, a couple of weeks ago, and talking about the British planes, and in general that the British had planes that they could use. Long-distance fighter bombers that they could use a longer distance to come into Germany without bringing in those big, huge planes and doing a big, huge bombing.
Right, the Mosquito, right.
Yeah. So why don't you start that however you want to. And I've got the comments from the gentleman. It was Lurker, actually. His name uses the name Lurker. But if you want me to... find anything that he actually said there. Did you hear that? I probably didn't understand. I've got the comments on the comment section in case you want me to refer to anything from there. Okay.
Well, the thing is, the Mosquito was a very good plane. It was a long-distance twin-engined, medium-sized, smallish fighter-bomber and reconnaissance plane. High altitude, it might cruise around at the altitude of about, say, 32,000 feet or even higher.
Well, how would you, that's called, what classification is that? And after that came the Mustang, but how does that compare to what the Germans were using and what Leopold Wenger was using, which was the FW-190? Totally different kind of plane.
The Focke-Wulf 190 was in many ways a very excellent plane, but the way it was constructed, the wings were kind of stubby to make it more maneuverable. And it also had an air-cooled engine. And air-cooled engines above a certain height, unless you put superchargers on them and stuff like that, start losing power. Of course, so do others. But anyway, with those wings, they were unable to become really effective above 27,000, 28,000 feet. And that's the height at which the mosquitoes flew. So the mosquitoes are, for the most part, rather impervious to German defense measures, you know. Unfortunately, the German side also extremely good twin-engine planes similar to the Mosquito, one of them being built by Heinkel, H-E-I-N-K-E-L, excuse me. But somehow it never made in the conclusion of the war or something, I don't know. Maybe it was a bit too expensive to manufacture. Only a few hundred of them were manufactured, even though that the Heinkel plane was even faster than the Mosquito, also high altitude, and would have been an ideal night fighter against British four-engine bombers. Now, let me say one more thing here. That Heinkel was named for a famous German airplane constructor and engineer starting his career in the First World War, and then, of course, establishing some famous airplane plants, and mainly in northern Germany, after 1933, 1934. But it so happens that Heinkel was a Jew. I mean, racially, he was a Jew. He never probably saw the inside of a synagogue in his entire life, but racially, he was a Jew. And then the claim is that the National Socialists were bent on destroying anything that looked like a Jew, which is totally untrue. Mm-hmm. And it is one of the outstanding examples of Jewishness producing German airplanes.
There was no problem among the Germans with this Heinkel, because they recognized his genius and his contribution there.
Right.
It was, you're just talking about the propaganda, how untrue
right.
it is.
That's right.
I was afraid you were going to say, oh, they got rid of the Heinkels and they didn't produce that plane because he was a Jew. I thought, oh, that's not too smart.
There are many other points that might be touched upon. Oh, yeah. At the very beginning, just to be fair, you know, at the very beginning, 1942-43, when the Americans started that daylight bombing of Germany, first of France and then Germany, they did concentrate on industrial areas. Now, one of the areas they attacked was Regensburg, which was a small city on the Danube in northern Bavaria. It's a beautiful old city, and at that time it had a population of about 70,000. It was small. But on the outskirts, there was a village which had been annexed a few years before. The village, the name of the village is Obertraubing. Nobody can pronounce it unless you know Bavaria, you know. But Obertraubing, Obertraubling. And that's where the Messerschmitt works, one of the Messerschmitt works was. And the Americans bombed the Messerschmitt plant and suffered very heavy casualties, because at that time the American fighters were unable to accompany the bombers into Germany because they lacked the range. But even though they flattened that particular village and especially the Messerschmitt plant, they did not bomb the historic center of Regensburg with a cathedral and many monasteries and churches and palaces and mansions and so on. That was untouched, except for the railroad station and its environs around there that was bombed. But so at that particular time, the beginning of 1943, they had not yet progressed or degressed or whatever to the point of attacking civilian targets the way they did later on in Munich and, of course, Hamburg, and later on at the end in Dresden, you know.
Mm.
So at the beginning, there was some hands-off policy, at least officially by the American Air Corps, Army Air Corps. Another interesting thing is that Obertraubling, the leftover, Messerschmitt works was then, after the war, made open to various enterprises, you know, private enterprises. One of them, lo and behold, was a Jew from Eastern Poland. I don't know his name, but he built a tannery in one part of the Messerschmitt plant, big tannery, and he wanted my dad to manage that tannery. Unfortunately, my mother and I were against it for some stupid reasons, because at that time in 1947, Regensburg was still in very bad condition and had not been painted or maintained since God knows when, in 1937, 1938. It looked bad. It was overrun with expellees and refugees from Eastern Europe. So my mother and I prevailed on Dad not to be manager of this tannery. Might have been better if he had stayed there. But anyway, so the owner of this tannery was an Eastern Jew from Eastern Poland. But he was not the only one. There were tens of thousands of, possibly hundreds of thousands of Jews from Eastern Poland who fled the communist rule, Eastern Poland, possibly Ukraine, and came into Germany, the Federal Republic, or I should say at that time Federal Republic didn't exist, the states of Bavaria and Hesse and Lower Saxony, and Austria as well, Vienna and Austria. And I know that the one town where I and hundreds of other students went to academic high school, the largest hotel right next to the railroad station, because we went to school by railroad every day, by train. The largest hotel was filled to the bursting point with Jewish refugees from Eastern Poland who fled communism, and they fled communism because all of them, or most of them, were small-time merchants. And then commercial dealings were being disrupted by communism, nationalized and state-ized, you know, owned by the state and by the Communist Party. So they all fled and went to Bavaria and Vienna. In Vienna itself, there were at least 27,000 Eastern Polish Jews.
Now, yeah. Now, what city was this in? Where you were living and you went to school? I forgot because you talked about.
The name of the city is Kamm, Cham. Kamm. It's in northeastern Bavaria, north of the.
Cham.
Cham.
And how big is that? How, you know, like then
it
and now?
It was a small city of about 12,000, something like that.
Okay. And this is
a county seat. Yeah.
Okay, a county seat. And you were going on the train. I remember you say you were going to high school on the train every day. And is that the place where you said you passed by this concentration camp type place with Germans in it? Place or something, German refugees, and the people were sitting going to the toilet outdoors, sitting on this pole, and things like that.
Oh, yeah, that was in right the town which we lived in. Is the last Bavarian terminus of the railroad station, of the railroad line The railroad goes right through that town, across the border into Bohemia. I know what used to be Bohemia, and during the Austro-Hungarian Empire, the same old borders remained. So when all these millions of Germans were expelled from so-called Czechoslovakia,
mm-hmm.
from Bohemia and Moravia, many of them came through the town because it was on the border. And there was a refugee camp.
Yeah.
And that included a cousin of my mother's, and I visited them for a few times. They were, you know, living in wooden barracks, and perhaps, hard to say, 300 people per barrack. And that lady, my mother's second cousin, she lived there with a small son, with a two parents and a brother-in-law, all of them in an area of about 8 by 6 feet. Mm-hmm. That was the place they lived in.
Mm-hmm.
There were
yeah.
bunk beds, you know, there were bunk beds on either side, and they had blankets sealing off the other side of the bunk bed so you couldn't see your neighbors too much. Of course, you didn't hear everything, and the smell probably wasn't too good either, with so many hundreds of people being crowded together in small barracks.
Mm-hmm.
And the toilets were all outdoors, and they were very primitive kind of natural type of toilet, you know, with a hole in the ground, and that's where you had to go to perform your natural duty.
Yeah. And, it was all out in the open, and people traveling by. Like
exactly.
You said, you were a schoolboy and you could see them.
That's right.
And that's what the people had to deal with then, just trying to survive.
That's right.
Really awful. But now here, at this time, Cham, you said that, is this right that you were going to high school and
right.
all these Jews were in this,
hotel.
Hotel.
Yeah. And there was another town about maybe 12 miles away west of that, which had a large camp of Jewish refugees from eastern Poland and probably the Ukraine who fled communism because they were afraid that their business would be nationalized by the Communist Party or the Communist regime. So many tens of thousands, probably hundreds of thousands, came into Bavaria and Hesse and Austria and Vienna and all those places looking for business, I guess.
And they, you know, if they came, these people, they had, if they came to save their business, they must have brought enough with them. Did they come with lots of goods and did they have money and so on? Or how were
they? Yeah, they must have. I remember at least one of them or one family. The town we lived in had weekly markets and out in the open. And I remember my father bought some textiles from them, from one of them. Yeah, textiles of various quality, you know, silk and thin and all that.
Mm-hmm.
And so my father bought some woolen cloth, and he had a suit made for him, for himself, because we didn't go to any supermarket or stuff like that. We had our private tailors, you know, and also private cowboys. All the shoes and all that were made, custom-made by tailors and cowboys. And so at this particular weekly market, there were several Jews selling these textiles, among other things. And very interestingly, then when we got into Chicago in 1952, one of those families happened to be there on the northwest side of Chicago. And they went to some kind of evening course learning English together with my parents. Because when my father attended high school, English was not considered up to snuff there to learn French, Greek, and Latin.
Mm. Yeah. So he then had to learn English, too.
He had to learn English in Chicago. And they met again, this particular Jewish family who had fled from Eastern Poland, from whom he had bought the textiles to have his suits made from, suits and coats. It was really interesting.
Huh. So they did all right. You know, all those Jews did all right.
Yeah, they did. There was no killing, no genocide, no sticking into concentration camps, anything like that.
No. And now what about this 3.2 million Jews that are missing from the Eastern Soviet Union? What were you referring to with that?
Oh, yeah, I read this also in this book by the author Erich Kern, K-E-R-N. He quotes in an American rabbi by the name of Schultz, I believe, who said in 1951 that the Eastern Soviet Union, not the part that had been conquered by Hitler's army, but the Eastern Soviet Union, had around 3.3 million Jews missing. In other words, they were got rid of by the Soviets by some means or other.
Well, yes. And did he have anything to back that up?
Because
I'm thinking of the recent book that's come out by Matonio Graf and Thomas Kues. And
yeah.
Part of Thomas Q, in response to the five bloggers, and they go into more detail than ever in defending their positions about the Reinhardt camps.
Yeah.
Reinhardt camps. In the Sobibor, Treblinka, and Belzec. And in Thomas Q's part, which I found actually the most interesting because it was new to me, where he does quite a lot of research and of what he could come up with, that that there were a lot of newspaper reports in the Soviet Union and elsewhere by Jews and Jewish papers and Jewish news services and so on, talking about the disappearing Jews in the Soviet Union right at the time of the, maybe even before the end of the war, but some of it, and after the end of the war, that these Jews kept disappearing. And it got into, you know, like you could say maybe a million. I mean, there's no accurate count, but they were coming from everywhere. That seemed, and then it was also said that they were being sent to Siberia. They were, you know, being sent wholesale to the gulags. So that agrees with this this rabbi that Eric Kern was talking about. When did Eric Kern write about this?
This was around 1951.
Wow. See? Long ago.
Right.
So this is something you never hear about, you know, that of all these reports and all these Jews that, and even the Jews don't want to talk about it now because they no longer want to blame the Soviet. They don't want to take away from their 6 million that they blame on the Nazis.
Right.
You know, this goes under the radar. This needs to have more people looking into it, I think, although it's probably very difficult. And you might not get more than what they've got now. But there were, I mean, when they put this stuff in the newspaper reports. And the Jews were busy reporting on it in all their papers, all over the place. Then it's got to have some credibility.
That's right.
Yeah. So is there any more to say about that?
Well, of course, that's an unending subject, a never-ending subject. So you could talk about that for eternity. But
And then you said it was areas untouched by Himmler.
Right, exactly. It was east of whatever, you know, east of the Volga, east of Moscow, those areas.
So closer to the west?
No, towards Siberia.
Oh, east. See, I go backwards. My mind goes backwards. Yeah, okay. Way out in the east. Yeah, all right.
Right.
Yeah. But the Germans hadn't gotten that far east.
No.
But the Jews had been sent that far east. And what I remember from all that is that, that Stalin, the idea was that Stalin, didn't trust these Jews, because they weren't Russian Jews to begin with. They were Jews that had been from Europe, actually, you know,
yeah.
The ones that were supposed to have been murdered by the Nazis. And if they weren't born and bred and of what he called Russian Jewish stock, then he thought they too, oh, he was just so paranoid and suspicious. So he got rid of them.
Yeah.
Yeah. Pretty interesting. And, you know, it's just too bad we don't have the smoking gun, the hardcore proof. I mean, there's plenty of evidence there, more than what they give for their theories.
Exactly.
But you can't get, you know, you can't make people think about it or look at it or believe it very easily. I suppose if there was a big cooperative push about it, you know, if you get enough people talking about it and pushing it all together, it might start to make some impact. But if it's just somebody here and there, you know, it gets lost.
Another thing is that Stalin, at least the hardline communists, accused Stalin of killing millions of communists in addition to other people.
Well, right, he did too, didn't he?
Yeah, he did, in his purges.
Yeah. Well, he was a killer. He was a huge, he just killed people right and left. And then he was supposed to be such a family man or something like that. You know, but,
well,
he wasn't that nice to his family either.
No. His first wife was a Volga German. The one who had, Svetlana Aleluyeva, the one who fled to America, whenever it was, 50 years ago, something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And she married that American architect who was the successor to Frank Lloyd Wright in Arizona. But she didn't like it. She didn't want to live in a commune because she said, if I want to live in a commune, I can go back to Russia. And anyway, her mother was a Volga German, and her mother was allegedly killed by Stalin.
His first wife's mother. His first wife. No, not his first wife.
His first wife.
His wife's mother.
The mother of Svetlana.
Oh, you said that she fled to the United States.
The daughter did, yeah. Svetlana did. And then she got married to an American architect.
Okay. It was Svetlana that came to the United States, right?
Yeah.
And she was supposed to be his favorite,
right?
Right. Up until a certain point. Well, that was one of the sickest societies and groups of people that you can ever come across. I mean,
yeah.
You get into reading about those people and what it was like to live there during that time. And all the way back to the Russian Revolution was just the most horrible way of life. God.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, they want to focus on the few years of the Third Reich, how terrible it was.
That's right.
Yeah.
Well, one thing you have to say is that Stalin did succeed in building up a heavy industry, especially armament industry, for constructing tanks and, to some extent, airplanes and so on.
Yeah, and he started that before there was any real threat of war, didn't
right.
he? I mean, he started building up. He was planning his own invasion of Europe long before.
Right. The interesting thing is that in October 1940, Molotov, the Ford Commissar of the Soviet Union, flew to Berlin. It was a big a court entourage, and he had talks with Ribbentrop, the German foreign minister, and Hitler and so on. And he made two great demands upon Germany at that time. One was a traditional demand for Russian ownership of the Turkish Straits, you know, the Dardanelles and Bosporus. In other words, Istanbul and then an entire area and Adrianople was supposed to be taken over by the Soviet Union or by the Russians, and also Eastern Turkey. That was one of the demands, a traditional demand of Russian expansionism going back to Peter the Great, even before that. But the other demand was, that was really astounding, was the demand for Soviet naval and army base in southern Scandinavia, say southern Norway, possibly southern Sweden. Now, if Hitler had acceded to that, then Europe would have been in the grips of the Soviet Union in the south. Southeast, there would have been a Russian power in what now is Turkey in the eastern Mediterranean, also threatening the Suez Canal. In the north, there would have been the Soviet bases in southern Scandinavia. So the Soviets would have had all of Europe in their jaw, you know, and they could just clamp down on it. That was one big reason why Hitler attacked the Soviet Union.
That's right. That's right. They had all the clues there. They realized what they were doing, what they wanted, and that they weren't going to ever stop their demands. They were never going to give up.
Right.
And so he knew he had to do something. He had to. And right. There was nobody else was going to do it. And, you know, this war with Great Britain, as, you know, as I think it was brought out in these comments that from your last program, that it was not possible for Germany to attack and defeat Britain and occupy the island and all of that stuff. That it was never possible, and Germany knew it, and Hitler wasn't really going for that, but he was trying to put up enough of a problem for Britain that they would stop fighting him and allow him to attack the East. And this was always Hitler's hope. And people don't understand when they try to point out, oh, Hitler did this stupid thing, he did that stupid thing. Oh, he could have taken over. Oh, he should have taken over Britain at Dunkirk, and that would have been done for, and they would have been out of the Britain was backed up by the United States, you know. I mean, none of that stuff makes any sense that these foolish people go on and on about. Hitler wasn't stupid, and he had good intelligence, and they were looking at everything and doing the best that they could to bring about European unity to go against the real enemy, but never could do it with somebody like Churchill in there.
Right.
And then Roosevelt, where you have these leaders are crucial as to what kind of leader you have.
Yeah.
Well, I know you never have anything good to say about Churchill.
Not much. He was born on my name's day. My name's day, which is, you know, St. Andrew or Andreas, is on 30th of November, and it's Churchill's birthday. So it's the only good thing you can tell about him.
Yeah. Well, for people who believe in names days, a lot of people are named Andrew. They can all be aware that Churchill was born on their names,
right.
St. Andrew's Day. Well, you don't like Barack Obama either, but you said there's not a, but you think he's an Indonesian.
Yeah. I think there's good reason to believe, of course you can't prove it, you know, that he was born in Indonesia, that his father was not from Kenya, but an Indonesian. Because, of course, this is all just, not speculation, because if you look at his face, you can tell it's very mixed Indonesian. But part of what today is Indonesia belonged to the Portuguese Empire, like East Timor, that was a Portuguese colony, and then the huge island that looks like a crab, sort of, with various arms. It's nowadays it's called Sulawesi, but in those days it was called, in the colonial days, Celebesh, and part of Celebesh was owned by the Portuguese, and what they did, excuse me, is import African slaves into their Asian colonies. They took them African slaves into Goa in India, for instance, and they also took some African slaves into what today is Indonesia. So these people then mixed with the native Malay population, and they came up looking pretty much like Obama does, you know. Now, of course, there's always the...
Well, he doesn't look anything like that Obama... Yeah, that Obama father's...
He's allegedly, yeah, the African father.
So black, and he just doesn't have any kind of resemblance to him.
That's right, no resemblance at all.
No.
But, well, anyway, let's be that as it may. If that's true, if that claim is true, then you could say that, well, that Obama would be the first American president or emperor who imitated the ancient Roman Caesars, because the old Roman Caesars, after Augustus and Nero and Claudius and all those people who are Romans and Italians, many of the others were not Italians, but they came from Spain, like Trajan, and from Dalmatia, like Aurelian, and there was one individual also called Philip the Arab, I believe. He didn't reign for very long, because most of those emperors were killed by the Praetorian Guard. But anyway, there was at least one Arab. Actually, there were several Syrians who became Roman emperors. So you can say, well, if they claim it's true, then Barack Obama is the first American emperor to imitate the old Roman Caesars of 1800 or 1700 years ago, you know.
Oh, well, that's something only you could come up with, because my knowledge of history doesn't, I can't judge these times and so on very well. Well,
it's to speculate on, you know.
Yeah. Well, you say that the big man on earth is not Obama, which we all know that anyway, but you say it's Netanyahu.
Yes. Just look at all the members of Congress, senators and representatives and so on. If Netanyahu goes to Washington, D.C., they just swarm him, you know, laughing. Big happy eyes with beaming faces. Oh, Netan, come and touch me, please, because your touch will reassure my re-election, you know. But if Netanyahu is against them, if there's anything that any one of these members of Congress even remotely makes Netanyahu and his ilk mad, they will lose the re-election for sure, you know. So who's actually ruling this country? Is it the president or the executive or somebody else?
Well, don't you think that there's big men on earth that are ahead, that are above Netanyahu?
Well, I can't come up with anybody. Of course, there are people like the Chinese president and.
You're thinking Putin. About actual elected officials and so on. I was thinking about International Jewelry, who has to be, you know, run by some people who aren't actually elected politicians.
Right.
But correct. Still, in the area of world politics, you say it's Netanyahu, and it's not anybody from France, or it's not Merkel, or
no.
It's not any of these people. No. Well, I don't know what interest, if you are very familiar with, you probably are, but how interested you are in the White Rose Society, Andreas. Are you pretty familiar with that?
I'm not terribly familiar with that one, no. Why didn't you tell me about it?
Oh, okay. Well, I wanted to mention it today because I learned that that I missed the anniversary. One of the anniversaries, which was February 18th, which was when the Hans and Sophie Scholl were arrested at the University of Munich.
Again. And there's a square named for them. Yeah.
Yes.
Right.
Yes.
The heart of the University of Munich. Yeah.
Right. And so now that's been made. And into another one of these World War II propaganda lies that they are these great, brave young people standing up for freedom and so on against the Third Reich. And so it came to an end when they were arrested at the University of Munich on February 18th, 1943, still pretty early in the war. And the whole story, well, I've gone into it some on a couple of programs. I find it very, very interesting story because it's just the turnaround. You know, I think that how they were treated by the German government and the people's was very fair. They were even treated well by the Gestapo, and they were executed, and with good cause they were executed. And there's some. I thought I would. Bring that up to date because, or talk about that a little bit because people were, you know, sending someone, oh, it's that Paul Eisen had on his blog that, he thought he didn't seem to know much about it. But he's a Jewish blogger who, says he's a Holocaust denier, but he doesn't like the National Socialists and he doesn't like the Hitler regime at all. And so that, you know, to me that two things have to kind of correspond a little bit. With him they don't. So he recommended that movie. There's a movie that's been made, which is just really god awful propaganda and articles are being written. And the fact is that, here's a few facts I just want to cover. In 1941, this Hans Scholl read a copy of a sermon by, guess who, Bishop August von Galen, who had so much authority in Germany with the Germans, and was anti-Nazi. And he was decrying the euthanasia policies at that time, and which program was ended. And I'm going to do a program on that pretty soon. But the thing is that his the Scholl's father, Robert Scholl, was a very leftist politician, and he didn't have a real career or anything. He wanted to be mayor of these different cities, and he was mayor of two cities, Forchtenberg, Berg, and Ludwigsburg, in the early 30s.
Yeah.
And then he couldn't get elected again in Ulm, so he went to school, night school, and he started a tax accounting service. And his wife was 10 years older than him, and then they had all these children, about five of them or so. And he was a liberal Democrat, and he was, you know, naturally wanting to influence his children, but they kind of liked the... They were kind of going along with the Hitler Youth programs and so on, but then they got discouraged about it. Anyway, Hans went to university and then he got into a medical school, and then Sophie followed him into University of Munich a few years later, and you know, a student there. When Hans got together with this half Russian German guy who came to Germany with his family when he was young. His Russian mother died, and his German father married another woman, and he was brought up. But he always loved his Russian mother most, and he seemed to love Russia most. And so they got together and decided that they needed to do something. Now my thinking about this is this whole story. that these young people had all these feelings, and they were writing these leaflets and passing them out at the, you know, what do you call that? You know, at the risking their lives and so on because of their beliefs. That it seems like everything that they did was very, very much directed by Soviet propaganda. And very much they were talking about things that were known in the Polish underground. The Polish underground, including in the Auschwitz camp and so on, were putting out. But how did they know all this? I don't know. Their first leaflet, they write, and this was in 1942. They started out in June 1942. They write, "Isn't it true that every honest German is ashamed of his government these days?" And then they say, "Who, you know, how the dimensions of shame that are going to befall us and our children someday when the veil has fallen and from our eyes in the most horrible of crimes that infinitely outdistance every human measure, reach the light of day." Well, nobody was thinking along lines like that. They didn't know that such stories were going to be coming out, but they were just newly coming out, you know. This is definitely Soviet propaganda that horrible crimes were committed, you know, and they were going to outdistance everything that anybody had ever done before. And this makes me suspicious. Then in leaflet number two, which would have been still in 1942, because they are arrested in February 18th, 1943. So they were just in the very early part of 1943, and they're even coming to an end, and they're going to quit doing what they had been doing, supposedly. But in the second one, they write, "Since the conquest of Poland, 300,000 Jews have been murdered in this country," meaning Poland, "in the most bestial way." Well, who was saying that in 1942? And the German people slumber on in dull, stupid sleep and encourage the fascist criminals, that's another Soviet term. Each wants to be exonerated of guilt. Each one continues on his way with the most placid, calm conscience. But he cannot be exonerated. He is guilty, guilty, guilty. This sounds so much like Soviet propaganda.
It really does.
I mean, this is just the way, and this was already the idea that they had to make the German people, they say the German people, you people, if you don't do something, you're guilty, guilty, guilty. You know, guilty. And I think that this whole idea, as you were talking about the bombing plans and so on, was started pretty far back, at least, you know, in 38, 39 and so on. And this guy's first partner was this half Russian who continued to love Russia more than Germany. He said so. And he, you know, even though he was a child when he came to Germany and continued to want to go back there. And, you know, and he said after the war, he was going to return and live out his life there and so on. And I wonder what kind of connections he had with, and then they had these clear connections with Bonhoeffer, who was a traitor, and all these other traitors. I've got some of the names here, but who they were working with and talking to and so on. And then they make Sophie Scholl, his younger sister, when she went to university, through just being around him, she found out what he was up to. And she wanted to be a part of it, and he couldn't talk her out of it, so he let her join. And she didn't do all that much, but now she's made into this big heroine because it's the right kind of a story, you know, the brother and sister, you know, and she was only about, what, go ahead.
Sort of like Anne Frank. You know, Anne Frank is another one of those fiction stories.
Well, yes, exactly, and that's what I think this is, and yet people just don't question it one bit, so I think more needs to be said about it. Now, four, they write this, and they only had six. There was a seventh. I think that's the way it went. There was a seventh, and that never got actually published. but he had it in his pocket or something. It gets a little confusing, and I forget the details of the story. But there are other members. There are some other members, plus this professor from the University of Munich. I mean, it's all evolved in Munich. And in this fourth leaflet, they wrote, and I think this is suspicious, "We wish expressly to point out that the White Rose is not in the pay of any foreign power." Oh, why would they even say so? They must have been. Then they go on and say, from there, "Though we know that National Socialist power must be broken by military means." See, they want, and what they were guilty of that was really so bad was they were trying to get the soldiers to lose. They wanted Germany to lose the battles and so on. I mean, this was real treason in what was going on, in that they were trying to undermine the military success and so on. And they say, "We are trying, but even though we know that's what has to happen, we are trying to achieve a renewal from within of the severely wounded German spirit." Here's some more of this propaganda now. "This rebirth must be preceded, however, by a clear recognition of all the guilt with which the German people have burdened, and by an uncompromising battle against Hitler and his all too many minions, party members, Quislings, and the like."
A lot of malarkey.
Well, it's exactly what was going on in Nuremberg.
They
say, "With total brutality, the chasm that separates the better portion of the nation from everything that is opened wide. For Hitler and his followers, there is no punishment on this earth commensurate with their crimes." And here these kids are, you know, they weren't kids. This Hans was like around 27 or something by then. But, you know, these young people are writing these kind of things that sound exactly what the Nuremberg Tribunal, how they based everything they said and did on, you know, it just is too close to it. So I think that's mainly, I have a lot of stuff from the last time I was here, but that's mainly what I had to say about it.
That's one interesting thing. I'm just reading a book on fighting Bob La Follette, the great governor and U.S. senator from Wisconsin. It just came out by an author named Richard Drake, D-R-A-K-E.
What's the senator's name again?
Robert La Follette.
Von Follette, yeah.
La Follette,
yeah.
It's called The Education of an Anti-Imperialist.
Yeah, he was a middle Westerner, wasn't he?
Right. He was from Wisconsin.
Yeah, okay.
But anyway, it shows here that the at least was an important part of the American ruling circles, a ruling class, you might say, the Eastern Seaboard, Wall Street, and so on. A large part of that was possessed of very dark urges against Germany even a long, long time ago, like in 1914, 1917, when Wilson declared war on Germany. And there was one man, his name was Harvey, who was the editor-in-chief of the North American View at that time. It was a very influential magazine, North American Review. And nowadays it's been possibly supplanted by the National Review. But anyway, Harvey said, this was in 1917, that we should never stop fighting against Germany, even if peace has been declared, and go fighting it. And to begin with, morally diseased Germany would have to be quarantined for her attack upon civilization and unspeakable barbarities in the war, until chastened and civilized Germans shall be barred from the normal commercial and social intercourse of nations. It was right in this garbage in 1917, you know. Mm-hmm. And it seems to me, and apparently seems to Richard Drake, the author also, that an important part of the American ruling class in the Eastern Seaboard continued to hate Germany irrationally after 1917, after 1919, the so-called Peace Conference of Paris, you know. And they dug up all this crud in 1933 with Roosevelt coming to power. And then Roosevelt's Chicago speech, quarantine speech against Japan, Germany, and Italy, and his gigantic rearmament that Roosevelt actually had been running since 1933. Then in 1945, with Germany being vanquished and Italy and Japan, they dug up all this old crud and re-editorialized and gave it a new facade, you know, to fit the slightly changed circumstances. The Germany had to be kept down or possibly even wiped out, you know.
Would you consider at all that when we see this going on and going back and in the United States and in Great Britain, that this is behind all this really is Jews like Netanyahu? is the Jewish element that is inspiring so much of this at bottom? You know, I don't want to say, oh, everything is done by the Jews. Because, right. Or could it be an Anglo-Saxon hatred? Some people think it's an old Anglo-Saxon competition with Germans, because Germans, yeah. When they're allowed, when they unified, you know, they became so strong. But I just wonder if it's more than that, if there's also the Jews behind it. I believe the Jews made sure that Roosevelt got elected. And they probably had a lot to do with Churchill getting in. Well, we've got 60 seconds, so I'll let you finish up.
Exactly.
On this. Go ahead.
What you said about the Anglo-Saxons is true. You know, they, even though the Anglo-Saxons came from Germany in the 4th and 5th and 6th centuries A.D., then they were being replenished and conquered by the Normans and so on. And then through Christianity and Calvinism, you know, the mm-hmm. idea of being a chosen nation, referring back to the Old Testament, all of that made them turn against any kind of reasonably powerful Germany.
Okay, well, we've got 10 seconds, so we have to say goodbye. At least we had a pretty clean ending there. Yeah. Thank you so much, Dr. Vesterlay, and hope we'll do it again.
Hope so. It's been a pleasure.
All right.
Bye.
So long, everyone.
Thanks for listening. And be sure to visit Carolyn's website at carolynyager.com.